happy to present at this hour the second unit of this year's Bertelmann Lectures. With them go our thanks to the donor of the lectures, and of course particularly to our speaker this year. I'm glad that we had this very optimistic introduction of this service this morning, because Dr. Miller, being who he is and realizing that two of his textbooks, two of them, are required reading in this school, probably takes a slightly dim view of his reception. The unfree will syndrome, being what it is no surer way to kill a person before you ever see him than to have to read one of his textbooks. And I think it's real good that we have this man in our midst. He's the sort of man whose friends call him Randy, believe it or not. He is an Episcopal clergyman who, while he was a professor in this practical field of religious education already at Berkeley years ago, got a thriving parish off the ground with a national note, as I remember it at the time. And now is not merely a professor of religious education and one for whom his institution found a way to honor even more excellently in the past year, but as he told us last night, is also a director of religious education, which I assume, sir, you meant was in the parish situation and not just in the school. Which, as a professor of religious education, he is, but he means also in the parish. Other words, when this man tells us, as he did last night, in key words, the abstractions of religious education, he also clothes them in concreteness. And that's why we're happy to have Dr. Randolph Crump Miller with us. He set up a broad spectrum last night and announced that he would draw the target even finer at this hour, and I know we're all glad to hear him. Dr. Randolph Crump Miller of Yale.
The only thing worse than having to read somebody's textbook is having to buy it. Last night we worked over some terms, dialogue, engagement, kerygma, and tried to provide a setting for new thinking in Christian education, with the emphasis on the exchange of meanings between those who are members of the people of God, using engagement as a richer term than encounter or meeting, because the word engagement includes the sense of involvement or intertwining or engrafting, whereas an encounter can be between enemies. And we used kerygma primarily in the sense of the story that the Bible tells, in such a way that God's reality is revealed. And at the conclusion of that lecture, we said that Christian education means telling the story of God's mighty acts in such a way that the listener participates in the dialogue and comes into an engagement with God in his daily life. And therefore, he sees the meaning of his life in a new way, and he is reborn daily with Christ as he lives in community as a Christian in the world. Now, perhaps the most important thing that's happening as we now discuss resetting our sights in Christian education is to go back to this revolution in contemporary Christian thinking in terms of the rediscovery of the ministry of the laity. Because I am saved through faith and not through anything that I do, therefore I am to be worthy of my calling to serve God. This is the odd logic of the gospel. The ethical implications of the gospel are based on something that's already happened, based on a grace-faith relationship, And the ethical implications are in terms of the fruits of faith. And the ministry of the laos, the ministry of the laity, the ministry of the people of God is in response to what God has already done. The living God, and God is not dead in spite of some rumors among contemporary theologians, the living God initiates me into this ministry through my baptism. This is the act of initiation, God's act and the people's act. The symbolism that's used indicates that one is engrafted onto a body or onto a vine, that this is an organic union between the child who is baptized and the body of which Christ is the head. One therefore has certain functions as a member of this body. He becomes an instrument of Christ's ministry in the world. And this begins with baptism. It begins without the consent of the one being baptized. And it's the ministry that we are all given. Now, in order to understand this ministry, I need to be equipped. I have certain gifts, and I have the freedom to use or not to use these gifts. And so I need to understand the how and the why of this ministry. And so the job of Christian education turns on this equipping ministry. An equipping ministry that leads to discernment and to commitment and to further training. Now, the preparation for this ministry, in terms of discernment and commitment and the building up of God's people, which begins with baptism, moves finally beyond baptism. There is the opportunity somewhere for one to respond to his baptism by confirming the baptismal promise. There is the opportunity when one has come of age to say, this baptism made in my name is now my baptism. This theoretically is what confirmation would mean if we ever could move it out of a period of early adolescence where it's sort of a super Boy Scout oath. And in order that this may happen, that this baptism may become mine, there needs to be dialogue, there needs to be engagement, there needs to be the hearing and the acting out of the story that the Bible tells, the kerygma. And this has to be in terms of the religious issues in one's life, the religious issues where the gospel comes alive. As long as the gospel remains in a book, it doesn't come alive. It comes alive in the existential moment when I have to make a decision. And then I begin to carry out my mission in the world. Now, with this understanding of one's nurture in Christian faith, there comes a point at which one makes a commitment, a decision, an act of faith, an act of trust, as a response to a moment of discernment, a moment of God's self-disclosure, an appropriation of revelation. I don't care what language you use. The point is that somehow the ice breaks, the light shines, and one responds with a yes or a no. And if one responds with a yes, he then moves into the company of the committed. And that's the point at which he needs a lot more education. So the primary emphasis on resetting our sights in Christian education is on the education of the adult laity. For without this, nothing much happens except the nurture of juveniles. And I think there's some people who think that's all there is to Christian education. There are many fathers and mothers who say Christian education is good for kids. But then you grow up, you can forget about it. And someone has once suggested that because many church school children quit after the eighth grade, they have the equivalent of a 12-year-old approach to Christianity, which is all right for 12-year-olds. The point is that they grow up, become adults, but not mature in the faith. And the average adult also has the approach to Christian education of a 12-year-old, which in the life of an adult means the approach to Christianity of a moron. And that's where most of our adults are. I cited some figures last night. of the findings of some research among Presbyterian parents. Parents who were enough concerned about the education of their children to take part in a research project. And if you read this Fairchild and Wynn study, you will discover that even those parents who are eager for good Christian nurture for their children are utterly and completely incompetent to do anything about it. This is part of the hopelessness of Christian education at that level. There's much that's hopeful at other levels. But this indicates that we must be greatly concerned with adult education in the church, and that we have to reset our sights at exactly this point. And we have to find the kind of method that will help us in this. Now, by method, I mean any means which provides a connection between the living God and the decisions of daily life. The method is the means of connection between these two. Much of the time we can talk about the problems of life, and we can talk about the story that the Bible tells and the meaning of the gospel. We never bring the two together. Until we bring the two together, there is no engagement, no dialogue, and the charisma has not been heard. We can begin either with the heritage of our Christian faith or with the religious issues in life. The factual information that is presented must be accurate, but more important, it must be relevant. I think a great deal of what we teach is factually correct, but who cares unless it's relevant to the issues in my life? And so relevance is important. And a great deal that we do in Christian education with children or adults is in helping them to ask questions or to deal with the questions they're already asking in such a way that the Christian heritage comes alive for them. Sometimes we can start with the story, and the story is relevant. If we start with the right Bible stories, we're almost always relevant. If you're dealing with a group of married couples and you start with the story of David and Bathsheba, you're going to be relevant. But most of us don't start there. The point is, you see, that the story may be relevant or the religious issue may be relevant, and oftentimes what Christian education is about is a religious issue looking for a relevant revelation to illuminate the religious issue. Now, dialogue, as we used it last night, may help people get ready for the kerygma. Or occasionally, the kerygma leads to dialogue. It can go either way. Sometimes you will hear the story and then enter into the interpersonal relationships of dialogue where meaning actually is communicated two ways. Sometimes it's only as meaning is communicated two ways is one enabled finally to hear the kerygma. And therefore, as we move into dialogue, there is hope that there will be engagement. Engagement in terms of self-involvement in the lives of others and in the life that God gives us. And when we get to this point, we have that freedom in which Christ makes us free. And the possibility of discernment and commitment, or of new discernment and renewal of commitment, which is really what should be happening on the adult level. Now, in this kind of a process, we don't operate from a dogmatic base, because what is revealed is not a series of propositions, but God Himself, God in action, the grace of God, the power of the Spirit. Again, we have a variety of terms pointing to this same reality. As I.T. Ramsey puts it, Professor Ramsey of Oxford, there can be no theological finality. Our whole lives must be spent in the adventure of formulating and teaching ever less inadequate maps of what has been revealed to us in that disclosure in which our Christian experience is grounded. Ever less inadequate maps. This is the point at which the teacher becomes humble, if he hasn't become already because of his failure. He recognizes now that no matter what model he uses and however he qualifies it, it is basically inadequate to point to the mystery of Almighty God. All that St. Paul could ever do was to say, "Behold, I show you a mystery." He left it for certain theologians to say, "Behold, I explain the mystery." And whenever the mystery seems to be explained, the strange thing is that God vanishes from the explanation. That's why so much theology is dry, dull, and irrelevant. And also the reason why theology, which is dynamic, is the most important single intellectual discipline of Christians, to learn to think theologically as we reflect on the meaning of our lives. Well, in this work with adults along these lines, one of the most important methods is group discussion. We hear about groups of adults getting together in church after church after church to talk things over. And there's no magic in this. No magic whatever. A lot of Christian educators talk about it as if there's magic. You just get people talking and somehow something will happen. Well, something will. You get a group of people together in order to talk and you have a debating society. Nobody hears what the other is saying because he's spending all of his time trying to score a point. This happens in lots of theological discussion groups in theological seminaries. Or again, a discussion group may have a hidden agenda. And all of a sudden, here there seems to be a free discussion, and someone suddenly comes up with a particular series of topics or a particular set of conclusions, and then develops the authority to say, "But we have to do this," when nobody has really consented to it. Or it may be the man in a group who is a skilled manipulator. And a great deal of so-called group discussion is merely highly skilled manipulation. Some industrial concerns, looking at the group dynamics process coming out of Bethel on the secular level, have discovered that if we only use group process in the factory, we can get everybody to do what we want to do because they think it's their idea. And there are some churches who use group process exactly in the same skilled, manipulative way as certain industrial groups. But when a group discussion is genuine, there is dialogue. When you have a genuine group, the members hear not only what the other person is saying, but what he means by what he says. And then exciting things begin to happen. And what you have in the group then is a desire for openness to what the other is saying, and consensus, if it occurs, is a byproduct and not a major goal. The problem is to become engaged with the claims of the gospel. And when this happens, there is changed behavior. And the sources for this sort of thing can be almost any kind of content. It can be a lecture, sometimes. It can be a book. It can be motion pictures. A television show, the telling of stories, role plays, almost anything can open up genuine dialogue in a group where there is concern for the welfare of the others in the group. And in such a group, there can be varieties of leadership. Some of the most effective adult discussion groups have no leadership whatever, or so it seems. They are leaderless groups. And because they are leaderless, their own concerns guide the discussion. Their interest is in the religious issues in the lives of the others, and they all contribute to the illumination that may occur as a result of this kind of a process. Or it may be a group where they are dealing with fairly technical problems and they invite in a resource person who is not the leader, but is there to be called on when needed. And there are other groups equally successful with a leader who is the expert, but who is capable of democratic leadership. In rare cases, this can be a clergyman. Ernest Southcott, Canon Southcott of Halton in Leeds in England, tells of his tours around to various discussion groups. And one night he was very late getting to one of the groups, and he stood at the door and heard some rather loud noises, so he listened for a minute or two and discovered that here was a kind of discussion the like of which he'd never listened to when he'd been present. And so he withheld knocking on the door and listened for a few minutes, and it suddenly dawned on him that although everybody in the parish trusted him and he was a resource leader of some value, on this particular night, the last thing in the world they needed in the group was the pastor. And he turned quietly and went away. And sometimes this is what the pastor has to recognize. Oftentimes, of course, the leadership in a group is dogmatic. There is one man who not only is a resource person, but he knows all the answers. And then the group becomes dependent on him or rebels against him, and in only very rare cases can dogmatic leadership operate in a group without tending to destroy the group, either in terms of dependency or of irrelevancy. The test, you see, is in terms of dialogue and engagement. And if these things occur, the group moves toward the possibility of increased discernment and commitment. And as I said last night, these can be almost any kinds of groups. It can be a group of Christian laymen who get together concerned about the meaning of their jobs. It can be Bible study groups, prayer groups, social problems, so forth. Almost anything can be the center of concern in such a group. And then, of course, there are those groups of adults with special concerns. One of the great ministries of the laity is the ministry of teaching. And I'm thinking now primarily of teaching in a Sunday school, although it would apply equally to parochial schools. Here is a great ministry of teaching, and the job of adult education here is the equipping ministry, equipping God's people for work in his service, which in the case of a church school teacher means service in a church school situation. Also, there is a place here for a special class for parents. For if we are ever to overcome the limitations of even our concerned parents, it can only be done through an adequate educational process with parents who are adults. It may lead to a reconsideration of the meaning of confirmation and confirmation instruction, where dialogue occurs, where commitment is prior to confirmation, there's a good chance that confirmation might stick. And this would really be news in every church. I don't know whether you have the problem that we have, but we confirm at 13 or 14 or 15. 5 years later, we can't find 80% of them. And confirmation as a rite is a mockery. And in all of this, what we hope is going to happen is that this kind of adult education is going to lead many of these adults, at least in their freedom, to what has been called a Christian style of life. And so as we reset our sights in Christian education, the first thing I think we need to do is to look very carefully at what we're doing with the adults in our parishes. Now, there are many others that need special help. I don't think the adults are the only neglected group. There are the deprived. We talked a bit last night about who they were. 3% of the children in any given area are likely to be retarded or handicapped sufficiently so that they cannot participate in a normal educational program in church or in school. And we lack adequate materials, adequate buildings, adequate specialist teachers. And as a result, most of these youngsters receive practically no Christian nurture. The deaf, the dumb, the blind, the physically handicapped, the mentally retarded who are not institutionalized. And here I think the answer, as we reset our sights, lies in ecumenical cooperation on the local and the national level. The same thing is true of our work in the inner city, our work with the isolated rural groups, the ethnic and racial minorities, the immigrants. Here again, it takes special materials, special training, special equipment to do the job. And perhaps the most important thing we need to do as we reset our sights at this level is the equipping of an emerging leadership. We have all learned the hard way in the so-called foreign mission field that nothing really begins to happen until there is indigenous leadership. We've seen this in the great churches of Africa and of India and of Asia. Churches begin to take on their own coloration, reflect their own cultural milieu, only as an indigenous leadership emerges. And as we look at Africa, for example, among those churches that have bishops, how many bishops are there in Africa who are nationals? The slowness with which we have allowed an indigenous ministry to emerge is one of the scandals of the church's missionary enterprise. And as we look at the inner city particularly, is there the possibility of equipping an emerging indigenous inner city ministry of the laity and of the clergy so that there can be a theology for the inner city that reflects these conditions? Most of our biblical imagery is rural and nomadic. And the only nomads in the inner city are those who run wild on the city streets, quite different from chasing across the desert and driving like Jehu. But if there is to be an emerging leadership in the inner city, we need to identify with them. There is no way to train a ministry, lay or clergy, from a distance. It simply cannot be done. Perhaps it can be done through the sector approach that Gibson Witter suggests, where the churches that operate primarily in the suburbs are pointed down like a piece of pie right into the very center of the inner city, the power center of our culture. Or there may be some hope if we can find unity in pluralism. This is something that is peculiar to the American religious scene. And again, I think we need to struggle here to reset our sights in Christian education. We know that we ought to be one in Christ, but we don't know how this is to be achieved, and most of us have a sneaking suspicion that most of us don't want it if we could have it, which points not to Christian education, but further back to the simple nature of the sin of our happy denominationalism. Another area in which we need to do some resetting of our sights is in looking at new techniques in Christian education. And remember what I've already said, that method is valuable only as it provides a connection between the Christian heritage and the religious issues in life, as this operates primarily in terms of dialogue and engagement. And we need to ask of any new technique whether or not it increases the effectiveness of dialogue and engagement. I suppose the most exciting new element in learning theory today is called programmed learning, the teaching machines, among other things. Certain kinds of books that are programmed for the right kind of repetition and reinforcement. Programmed learning is based almost entirely upon a very primitive educational theory of reinforcement, stimulus, something you can do with rats, therefore you can do with men. that said that educational psychology has gone through three cycles: the age of the rat, the age of the dog, and the age of the ape. And with the ape, we got something you can do with rats, therefore you can do with men. Consider that educational psychology has gone through three cycles: the age of the rat, the age of the dog, and the age of the ape. And with the ape, we got to gestalt psychology. But we haven't gotten beyond this yet to do any kind of real testing of the educational psychology of human beings. We know a good deal about educational psychology because we share so much with the rat, the dog, and the chimpanzee. You know, the teaching machine has value because it does offer the opportunity for a kind of solitary learning which someone can follow through at his own speed in the light of his own motivation. The average teaching machine is wonderful for somebody who likes to play solitaire. It doesn't help a bit for a fellow who prefers poker. And for certain tools of learning, they are extremely valuable. Language laboratories, for example, where you can play back your own voice, listen to others, make the comparison. The kind of learning that is done best in solitude is the learning of certain kind of language tools. I suppose it would do all of you good to sit down in the television room and watch over and over again that painful scene of yourself preaching a sermon on TV and sharing with no one else because the pain is going to be too great. But out of it in due time may come some new self-understanding. But I don't think this will come just from watching yourself on TV. It will only come in the dialogue and the engagement as you and others seek a common evaluation of what this means. Biblical information can be taught the same way. If you want someone to be able to identify a great number of biblical characters, or a great number of dates and so forth, you can program a teaching machine or a book or even a TV program in such a way that you will constantly reinforce your knowledge. If you happen to have a church history professor who wants you to memorize dates, and he thinks that dates somehow are magic, then by all means, set up some kind of a programmed learning situation. Memorize these dates, hand them back to the professor. The only trouble is that if you've done it adequately in the teaching machine, you'll have trouble forgetting the dates after you pass the exam. You'll be a handicap the rest of your life. The trouble with all of these program learning situations is, of course, that there's no place in them as such for dialogue or engagement. One doesn't hear the kerygma. All you get really are tools to be used in other kinds of learning. And if we recognize both the value and the limitation of this approach, I think perhaps we have a new way of getting at some of the things we need to do in Christian education. Then, of course, another new technique that dates back maybe 10 or 12 years is known as group process. The first Christian insight into this, I think, came from exposure to the secular theorists at Bethel in the group life laboratory. And some of this has been utilized quite effectively by the churches. But most of us, I think, as we look around at our Sunday schools, find the classes are too large for them to become a group. A Sunday school teacher says, "What can I do? I am alone with 45 children in three different grades." Because the only answer is divide them into three groups to start with. But where are the other two Christian adults sufficiently concerned to participate? And there are many churches that don't have enough concerned adults. And when we start talking then about the adequate size of classes of children, we're forced back to the adult education problem of who's going to be the teacher. The most radical approach to this is that of the Seabury series that was Protestant in the Episcopal Church. And you may have noticed by the newspaper during General Convention, we are still Protestants. In the skin of our teeth. But in the Seabury series, the recommendation is made that there should be no class of more than 12.
and that each class should have a teacher and an observer. Now, even with this set situation, nothing may occur. It can still be just as deadly as any other kind of a class. But if the observer is a process observer, who is able to help the teacher evaluate what's going on in terms of interpersonal relationships, in terms of participation, in terms of dialogue, in terms of hope for engagement, then the information from the observer may be used creatively to produce the kind of situation in which what I think is desirable education may occur. But you may have a church school situation where you have to have larger classes. You don't have adequate space, you don't have adequate teachers. And the Presbyterians have suggested a system of teen teachers. Have a larger class and have two or three teachers available, and then use the flexibility of moving from the large group for stories and visual aids and so forth to smaller groups when you want to have some kind of creative discussion. And this provides a kind of flexibility that you don't find in the Seabury series. But I think there's much less likelihood in this approach for dialogue and engagement to emerge. Also, in the new development of techniques and insights, there has been a tremendous revolution in the last 15 years in curriculum materials available in the Sunday school. This began in 1948 with the Christian Faith and Life materials of the Presbyterians. A very modest reinterpretation, educationally, a quite radical reinterpretation theologically. It was perhaps the first set of church school materials that took Karl Barth seriously. They didn't know quite what to do with it, but at least they took him seriously. And out of it came a theologically informed and a consistent theologically informed set of curriculum materials. 7 years later, in 1955, there appeared for the first time the Seabury series that I've already referred to, which had a theological base, not lined up so much with Karl Barth as with a dynamic view of Revelation, very close to that of Archbishop William Temple, where God reveals himself, and Revelation is defined as the coincidence of a divinely revealing event and a particularly appreciative mind. So that, says Archbishop Temple, there is no such thing as revealed truth. There are truths of Revelation. And with this dynamic point of view, the living God becomes more important than propositions about it. This is an empirical and an existential view of Revelation. The dynamic theology that evolved from this kind of an approach leads to a different approach to Christian education itself. It has great concern for the deep process that we've been talking about. With a centering of the curriculum on religious issues as the organizing principle, the religious issues in the life of the teacher, with small classes, with parent cooperation, with parents and children worshiping together. And the framework of such a free-flowing curriculum is, of course, the church year and the worship of the church. When you have a church year structure, you've got all the structure and sometimes more than you need for a church school curriculum. And therefore, your teacher's manual should be as free-flowing as the religious issues emerging in the lives of the youngsters. And when they worship together against the background of the themes of the church year, and then go to their classes, then you automatically have a referral to the ongoing life of a congregation, with its structure as the basis for structuring Christian education. And since 1955, there have been a number of other materials, such as the United Church of Christ, the Methodist Church, the Lutheran Church of America materials, and all of these have modified, to some extent, the Seabury approach, using the terms of less demands on teachers and clergy and more commercial success. If you're thinking of success rather than effectiveness, the Seabury series doesn't qualify. It's only used, even now, after 10 years, in 30% of the Episcopal churches. And they bootleg other materials in the other 70% of the churches. They're easier to use, they don't make quite this demand. And so the other churches, seeing this, have made certain alterations or compromises for commercial reasons. miss a lick on this, their material fell in 90% of their churches. But their penny stuck. No matter what kind of curriculum materials you use, you discover that you accomplish nothing without an adequate program of leadership education. Perhaps the Southern Baptists do this more thoroughly than anybody else, and this may account for their growth. The Southern Baptists, ideally at least, draft their teachers at least 1 year in advance and put them into weekly training sessions on Wednesday nights for a year before they allow them to teach in the church school. Because I know many other churches where they take 10th graders who are a little bit bored with Sunday school and put them into glorified babysitters in the nursery department and expect something to happen. Well, nothing does, except disaster. Perhaps one of the best systems of training teachers is a new system known as the trainer of trainers, where the job of the pastor or whoever on the staff, such as the director of Christian education, is responsible for the parish education program, trains the trainers, who in turn train the teachers. If you want to observe this in action, you can find it at Emmanuel Church in Webster Grove, where one of our Yale graduates is a director of Christian education. I won't tell you her name. Now, another very exciting element in this whole business of Christian education is the revolution that's going on in the area of the study of religious language. And we need to ask, what do the new developments in religious language tell us about Christian education? Some of you are familiar, perhaps, with the writings of the English logical empiricists. And they are now making a distinction between teaching factual knowledge, which they always claimed they could do, and teaching about faith. In the January issue of Religious Education, January 1965 issue of Religious Education, there will be a symposium on this whole problem. And the lead article will be written by Paul Van Buren, called Christian Education Postmortem Day. God is dead and Jesus is the incarnation of him. Is a caricature of what he is saying. The Paul Van Buren, writing the lead article, says that the proper understanding of religious language and its metaphysical implications can lead to freedom of faith, although God is not a metaphysical entity. The path to Christian education, says Paul Van Buren, is to tell the story, teaching the story as a story. Believers have a story to tell, not a photograph to look at. And the job of teaching about faith is very similar or analogous to teaching about love or about art. And nothing happens until a response is evoked. And to this article, which I have summarized all too briefly, there is a response by 8 American and English theologians and educators. Men like Gordon Kaufman of Harvard, Father Bernard Cook of Marquette University, and various others. And they take issue, of course, with Van Buren's metaphysical assumptions. But they say that he's on the right track educationally. They say that they agree with Van Buren that the specifically Christian stories need to be told. For the charisma precedes discernment and commitment. Dialogue, engagement, and charisma all precede discernment and commitment. But teaching now, the problem is that of the story. And these stories are not fiction. These are stories grounded in history, or they may be myths representing history, or they may be imaginary dramas reflecting profound human experience. And these stories are the central subject matter of Christian education. God is here and now. And the task of the story is not only to make it clear how God acted once upon a time, but how he acts in the here and the now. For this, we need the corrective of biblical scholarship, which Van Buren ignores. which Marcus Smart ignores in his treatment of Bible stories. But if we take seriously what Iris Tully has written in her book called Imparting the Word, we need to take seriously the findings of biblical scholarship in order to tell the story as story. In order that the stories may stand on their own feet, they need to have a relationship to the sits and Laban. We need to know the environment out of which they came, the reason for which they were told originally. And the purpose of these stories is not to lead to moral behavior, as Professor Braithwaite of Oxford suggests, but to a personal relationship with God. Paul Homer, in commenting on this whole program, says that the word God is used referringly. And by this, Homer means that when you use the word God, it is used in such a way that it evokes the reality of God. This is far different from using the word of God in vain, which oftentimes is done in the most pious of circumstances. How can we use the word God in such a way that it evokes the reality of God? This, you see, is a denial completely of the Van Buren thesis that God is dead. But it is saying that God is in the here and in the now to such a degree that the word God must carry some kind of supernatural currency in the storytelling. This is not fantasy but reality, where redemption is a hope and a possibility. And when the stories are told in this way, it leads to dialogue not only between men, but between God and man. A dialogue in which God is the chief actor, for the Bible gives him the priority that is his. And this evokes not just a disclosure, but a cosmic disclosure. And God is grounded in the cosmos of which he is the creator. This is taken very seriously, as you can see, not only a doctrine of incarnation, but a doctrine of creation. It is grounded in the reality of the process that leads to the dogmatic statement of the nature of the Trinity. It means also understanding that the language that we use is primarily that of poetry and of story. Canon Drinkwater of England says that there are four kinds of language we use: scientific difficult, scientific simple, poetic difficult, and poetic simple. The theology of Thomas Aquinas is scientific difficult, such as his Einstein theory of relativity. Most of us are content to reduce scientific difficult to scientific simple. And so we get the emotional power of a weather report or the answer to a catechetical question. And we think somehow this is Christian education when it's merely something that's been watered down from scientific difficult. Then there's a language he calls poetic difficult, like, I suppose, the poetry of Robert Browning and his work. And this doesn't help much either. And then he says when a poet uses the language of a heart, the language is going to lead to a disclosure and a commitment, he uses the language known as poetic simple. And as an English Roman Catholic, Canon Drinkwater suggests as the best example of poetic simple, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. But it also could be the work of Shakespeare, Good Night, Sweet Prince, and Angel, to thee, to thy rest. It could be the kind of doggerel poetry you read in the works of Geoffrey A. Sebbett Kennedy, the great wartime chaplain who writes in the doggerel poetry of the English heart, the language of the heart. And so the teacher, in our teacher training program, needs to be enabled to tell stories, to use poetic forms, to call on the resources of the various arts as a means to disclosure and commitment. And then finally, there's the problem of the church and Christian nurture as we reset our sights. An understanding of the nature of the church, as I try to describe it in Christian nurture in the church, which I think is one of the books we don't have to read. I'm not going to summarize it for you. But the main thesis here is that the church of the people of God are not distinguished from the rest of mankind in country or speech or customs. They remain on earth, but they are citizens of heaven. To put it briefly, what the soul is to the body, Christians are to the world. And as we reset our sights in Christian education, far beyond any technique, is this concern for the quality of life of the congregation as a whole. Whether or not there can be a sharing, a koinonia of gifts and insights. Whether there can be an openness to dialogue so that genuine engagement may occur. And the center of life of this congregation is in its worship, which is the environment in which Christian nurture occurs and in which the Holy Spirit is at work. When one goes to church to worship, he expects somehow to meet God there. Not in any pious sense, not necessarily in an emotional or mystical sense, but the reality of God at work in and through the members of the congregation who are engrafted onto the body of Christ. And out of this worship comes opportunity for Christian nurture, reflection on the meaning of worship, reflection on what has happened in worship, may be the most important element in what goes on in a church school class. And if worship is going to be effective, I suppose it involves a rethinking of the religious language of worship. For I'm not sure that God needs to be worshipped anymore in Latin, or in Hebrew, or in Greek, or in German, or in Elizabethan. Maybe in this country he needs to be worshipped in America. And I'm not sure what this will do to our liturgical scholars, but it's sure going to upset their concern with patristics. I would like to have said something about baptism, but there's no time. Let me move immediately to a conclusion and see if I can beat the bell. From where I sit, I see Christian education moving forward on all fronts. I see a growing concern with the religious issues in our lives, for dialogue, for engagement. I see a concern for the deprived, the retarded, the handicapped, the culturally limited. I see the beginning of new insights in the area of religious language. I see a concern for the quality of life of our congregations as they live and work together. But I do not see enough concerned adults, enough devoted and competent teachers, enough morally and spiritually sensitive leaders among clergy or lay people. Therefore, I see a challenge to us all to acknowledge Christ as our Savior and to see Christ in our neighbor, so that by God's grace we may become worthy to use our gifts of ministry in the vocation to which He has called us. For we are witnesses of the faith and ambassadors for Christ as we fulfill our ministry in the world. Thank you very much.